at NSA headquarters. They should be able to deal with any internal threat. Everything you've said points to an Al-Qaeda operation, Corey Mayfield interrupted. Like I said, I'm not buying it. President Jackson held up his hand, cutting off Director Mayfield's response. General Wilson, I respect your opinion, but I have to act based on what I consider the most likely scenario. Since we haven't been able to contact Colonel Abrams, the base commander, I've given the go for a Delta response.
Mr. President, local civilian police can get here faster.
I'm not putting civilian police up against a trained Al-Qaeda assault force. I've made my decision.
Yes, sir.
President Jackson broke the connection and turned to his chief of staff. Carol, get my press secretary in here. I'm going to have to make a statement in the next hour or so.
I called her 15 minutes ago. Gretchen's on her way, along with the rest of your national security staff.
That's good.
The president didn't intend to say what he was thinking, as if by refusing to give his thoughts voice, he might avert what they foretold. But somehow, the words found their way out of his mouth.
I've got a feeling it's going to be a long night.
Chapter 92. The door opened as Mark reached for the handle, Heather's smile breaking the ice that had enclosed his soul. Her gaze lingered for a moment on his full beard. Then, as Heather's gaze settled on Jennifer's limp body in his arms, the smile faded.
"Set her on the couch,"
Heather said, motioning toward what appeared to be a small break area beside a sink and coffee pot. As he gently released his twin's body, Heather bent over her, lifting one of Jennifer's eyelids, then the other.
"Damn it,"
Mark nodded.
"They've messed her up bad."
Standing up, Heather threw her arms around Mark's neck and hugged him tight. For a full 10 seconds, Mark held her close as his heart hammered the walls of his chest. As Heather pushed back, she pointed to the duty belts, service holsters, and spare clips on the table by the bank of monitors.
"You take one, and I'll take the other."
"What's the plan?"
"I've got the security teams, except for 2 wounded guys down on sublevel 4, pulled back to defend the building from outside attacks. Now that you're here, I'll open the doors that will let the rest of the Arab prisoners up stairwell 1. That should give the response teams plenty to think about."
She slid into the seat in front of the laptop, motioning Mark into the seat in front of the microphone that was hardwired to the 3rd and 4th sublevels.
"As soon as I open the right doors, get your best Arab terrorist voice ready."
Mark nodded in understanding and waited. Heather nodded.
"Okay."
Mark's Arabic flowed from his lips with a distinct Saudi Arabian accent.
"My brothers, we are here to free you. In his greatness, Allah has opened a way. Break contact with the infidels you now fight and move down the corridor to your rear. You will find the stairwell open all the way to the top. From there you must fight your way to freedom. Allahu Akbar."
Turning his attention to the monitors, Mark noted the speed with which the Arab fighters reacted to the command, leaving the 2 wounded security guards lying among the bodies of their fallen comrades in the disabled elevator. In less than 30 seconds, 16 terrorists had entered the stairwell and begun racing up the stairs toward the ground floor. With a clank, heavy steel bolts engaged, locking the door shut behind them.
"Time to go,"
said Heather, rising to her feet and strapping the remaining duty belt and holster around her waist, pausing to tuck in the excess. Odd as it seemed, Mark found the image of the gun belt wrapped around Heather's slender body, wearing only a blue hospital gown, remarkably appealing.
Stairwell 2?
No. We're going to have to climb the elevator shaft.
Her eyes moved to Jen.
Can you carry her on a cable climb?
If we strap her to my back, no problem.
Heather knelt down, stripping the dead guard's shirts and belts as Mark lifted his sister. Following her to the elevator shaft, Mark saw that the door stood open onto the empty shaft. Shifting Jennifer onto his back and wrapping her arms around his neck,
He let Heather strap Jen's hands together with a bloody shirt. Then, hooking both belts together, Heather fastened them around Mark's and Jennifer's bodies. She paused for a moment to inspect her work, then turned and leaped into the shaft, caught the thick cable, and began rapidly climbing. Mark followed, the added weight jolting his frame hard enough that he wondered if the cloth ties would handle the strain. They held, and he began steadily pulling himself hand over hand up the shaft.
"You good?" Heather asked from above. "Right behind you, all the way to the top.
We're making a short stop over on sublevel one."
"Why is that?"
"I found our laptops."
Chapter 93 Heather passed the open elevator door on sublevel two, continuing her steady climb until she hung suspended 3 feet above the opening into sublevel one. Swinging her body, she launched herself into space, landing in a forward roll that brought her back to her feet in the wet quarter as cold water rained down on her from above. As she'd seen on the security cameras, sublevel one had been completely evacuated once the fire alarms and waterworks had started. Nevertheless, she pulled the Beretta from the holster and chambered around. Moving forward in a shooter's crouch, she began clearing rooms left and right as she moved past them. To her rear, she heard Mark land and slide. Then he was beside her, moving with his own gun drawn, Jennifer dangling awkwardly from his back. Unlike on the lower sublevels, laboratories and offices filled this floor, a facility designed to provide close-in, real-time technical support to some of the best interrogation teams in the business. This was where equipment captured with the prisoners held below came to be analyzed and dissected, providing a rapid turnaround totally focused at providing corroboration or leverage on the former owners. A single cell phone often yielded information that skilled interrogators wielded on their subjects like Chinese water torture. Heather paused outside of the lab she had targeted, took a deep breath and held it. Opening the door, she stepped inside, grabbed the nearest chair, and used it to wedge the door wide open, letting the halon gas pour out into the hallway. The gas itself wasn't harmful, but it displaced the breathable nitrogen-oxygen mix that fires and people lived on. Without waiting for the gas to drain out into the hallway, Heather stepped into the room and turned on the lights, leaving Mark standing guard with Jennifer outside. The lab was a large room, 60 feet by 48, with raised flooring to accommodate the wiring that ran beneath it. Rows of workbenches divided the room into four sections. On the third of these, Heather found what she was searching for. Both laptops had been stripped, the motherboards and computing components plugged into other systems capable of recording all electrical activity in the circuits. Heather ignored them, selecting instead the two specially modified USB dongles. Removing these from their mounts, Heather dropped them in a small plastic Ziploc bag she retrieved from the supplies strewn across the workbench, and made her way back toward the door. Pausing momentarily to grab a white lab coat from a hanger by the lab entrance, she slipped out of the wet hospital gown, fastened the coat around her with the gun belt, and stepped back into the corridor. She'd been in the lab for just over 3 minutes, and she felt certain that she could have held her breath another seven. Still, it felt good to replace the old lung full with a fresh breath. Partially revived by the cold downpour, Jennifer was moving on Mark's back, in weak protest against the trusses that bound her to her brother. The sound of distant gunfire echoed from above.
"Got him?" Mark asked.
"What we need."
"So now it's up and out."
The shaft comes out in an elevator alcove about 50 feet from the main entrance. Right now, there's a serious fight going on up there. We should be able to get to the parking garage exit with minimal resistance.
Minimal?
3 to 5 guards, 87% probability based on my last look at the video.
Let's do it.
Heather led the way back to the shaft at a jog. Her last step propelled her out onto the cable.
The gunfire was louder now, interspersed with yells and screams of pain. She slowed her ascent as she approached the open door to the main elevator alcove. A black-clad guard crouched, facing away, firing down the hall toward the entrance. Heather shot him in the back of the head. Leaping into the alcove, she grabbed him by his heels and pulled him farther back into the alcove as Mark landed behind her. Heather yelled to make herself heard over the sound of the raging gun battle in the main foyer.
"Take his uniform. I'll cover you."
Mark unstrapped Jennifer as Heather grabbed the dead guard's short-barreled Mark 17 Scar H and magazines and took up a defensive crouch by the exit into the main corridor. When she glanced back again, Mark, dressed in black, was finishing lacing up his boots. Heather tossed him the Scar H.
"I'll carry Jen. You get us the hell out of here."
As she lifted Jennifer's body onto her shoulder, Heather saw Mark lean around the corner and squeeze off two quick shots. Seeing him motion her forward, Heather hit the hall in a dead run, heard Mark firing behind her as she ducked around the corner. A crouching guard saw her coming, paused to take in the girl in the white lab coat with an orange-clad woman slung over her shoulder, and hesitated. Heather's bullet took him between the eyes, the 9mm Parabellum slamming his lifeless body to the floor with an audible thump. As she reached the door out to the parking garage, Heather heard Mark's boots pounding down the hall behind her. Turning the handle in her hand, she stepped aside as Mark's shoulder hit the door, launching it into one of the two guards crouching outside. The other tried to level his weapon, but Mark was too fast, his booted foot catching the man in the chest with the force of a battering ram. Two trigger pulls ensured neither man would pose a continuing threat. Glancing back down the hallway, Heather saw an Arab prisoner peek around the corner. She squeezed off a round that caught him in the throat, sending him sprawling.
"Got their keys," Mark said. "Let's go."
Ducking as low as she could and still run with Jennifer slung over her shoulder, Heather followed Mark through the rows of cars while he clicked the alarm buttons on both key fobs. They were rewarded with the sound of a honking horn and the flash of headlights on a white Ford Edge halfway down the second row. Heather piled Jennifer into the back seat and climbed into the passenger seat as Mark threw the car into drive and squealed around the exit ramp. As Mark cornered out of the building, the mini SUV slid sideways, tires spewing black smoke as the rear window exploded in a hail of bullets. Heather emptied the Beretta along the calculated back trajectory, and then they were around the corner, headlights off. Sliding right onto K-9 Road, then left onto Rockenbach with all the speed Mark could extract from the new Ford.
"You're bleeding."
The concern in Mark's voice made Heather aware of a dull throbbing in her left temple. A quick touch and her hand came away bloody. "Just a glass scalp cut. Bleeds a lot, but I'm fine." At Cooper Avenue, Mark hung another left, letting the speed fall off naturally as they entered the wooded housing area. A left on 91st Division Boulevard led to Collier Loop and then Anderson Loop. Mark parked the Ford on the curb in the widest expanse between houses, turned off the interior lighting, opened the driver's door, and stepped out into darkness, a move that Heather duplicated on the passenger's side. As Heather opened the rear passenger door, Mark stepped up beside her.
"I'll get Jen. You take this."
He handed her the Mark 17 and lifted Jennifer from the back seat. Heather paused to listen to the cadence of distant gunfire and sirens, letting her mind play out the most likely scenarios. Someone would find the bullet-riddled vehicle first thing in the morning. That was just fine. She stepped away from the SUV, walking swiftly across the grassy expanse between houses and into the woods beyond, Mark striding silently by her side.
Chapter 94. Balls Wilson strode into the ice house foyer flanked by a Delta security detail. The Delta Force team had been on site less than an hour and had declared the area secure less than 10 minutes earlier. Whatever shape the building had been in during the initial firefight, Delta's arrival hadn't improved its structural integrity. A lean, square-jawed man, clad all in black, walked up to him.
"General Wilson, I'm Bob Chavez. I lead this team."
General Wilson's eyes took in the whole man. Typical Delta. Fit, cocky, more civvy merc than military. The type of man most special operators wanted to become.
"You got time to give me a tour?"
"All the time in the world, General. No more bad guys."
"Any alive?"
"A couple got away before we got here. The rest are dead. Couldn't keep 72 virgins waiting."
It was the answer Balls had expected. No real tragedy. They'd long since extracted all the information they were going to get out of the Arabs. It saved the government the expense and aggravation of a bunch of public trials. That would more than compensate for the cost of rebuilding this facility. The real loss was the three Gregory accomplices.
"Find any Anglo bodies?"
"Hard to tell. You'll need a good forensics team for that."
They started at the bottom, taking the main stairwell down to sublevel 4, and worked their way up, stopping to let Balls examine every cell, room, and laboratory, Chavez providing a full briefing as they walked. All the violent action had happened on sublevels 3 and 4, and on the ground floor. Those were a blood-spattered, bullet- and explosive-shattered mess. Damage on sublevels 1 and 2 seemed limited to water damage from the sprinklers. The labs all appeared in good shape, the reason they used Halon fire suppression systems. Ironic. People be damned. At least the electronics were safe. Balls paused in the first sublevel electronics lab, walking to Eileen Wu's workstation. As far as he could tell, nothing had been disturbed. The Gregory laptops still occupied the top of the workbench, their guts attached to an electronic forensic array. As he stared down at it, the thought occurred to Balls Wilson that in an android world, Eileen would be the perfect medical examiner. Well, she and the rest of the team would get their chance to see what equipment still worked after the real MEs finished with the slaughterhouse. Turning back to Bob Chavez, Balls nodded.
"Thanks, Bob. I can show myself out."
"Couldn't have that, General. You might trip on the stairs. How would that look on my report?"
The image of the grinning Chavez stayed with Balls Wilson all the way back to NSA headquarters.
Chapter 95.
Dr. Donald Stevenson wasn't happy. The accident had killed three people. More importantly, it had set back construction 2 weeks. Now he had a bunch of unionized French construction workers complaining about how the aggressive work schedule was jeopardizing worker safety. He'd just finished explaining to that collection of morons that if they didn't get back on schedule, a black hole was going to jeopardize workers' safety a hell of a lot more. Besides, if they did their jobs as they were supposed to, there wouldn't be any more accidents. Luckily, none of the new equipment had been damaged when the crane cable had broken, dropping a section of dismantled muon detectors back into the Atlas cavern, crushing three members of the construction crew. But the collapse had damaged needed construction equipment, thus the delay. Well, they'd just have to make it up. But not all the news was bad. Stevenson turned to the latest progress reports from the Matter Disruptor construction team. Apparently that foreman knew his ass from a hole in the ground. Having already completed the electrical conduit work, his team was actually ahead of schedule. At this pace, they'd be ready for the first small-scale matter-to-energy conversion test in a month. He logged into his computer, using a biometric fingerprint scan followed by a 64-character password that changed on an hourly basis. It was a formula Dr. Stevenson had designed, and that only he knew. Since the Nancy Anatole incident, he'd made a number of security enhancements so that he no longer had to worry about a hacker accessing his private system. Still, it was an inconvenience, one that didn't elevate his current mood. All his work these last 40-odd years had boiled down to this offshoot of the Roe Project.
He actually felt like shaking Freddie Hagerman's hand for pushing up his schedule. Thanksgiving night, when everything had gone so wrong, it had forced him to use Raoul to generate the anomaly, even at the cost of completely depleting the Roe ship's power cells, effectively killing it. But in 6 months, the world would wake up to a new dawn, a golden age of knowledge and enlightenment. Nobody knew this gateway's real purpose, and no one would dare try to stop him now. The November anomaly had made sure of that. Failure wasn't an option. Either this project succeeded on schedule, or the Earth, and eventually the entire solar system, would disappear into a new black hole, as its event horizon gobbled up anything that happened to pass within its reach. And with each gulp of additional matter, that horizon would expand. Shrugging aside all thoughts of the unthinkable, Dr. Stevenson set to work modifying the construction plan in the Atlas Cavern to remedy today's setback. The workers weren't going to like it, but they hadn't liked anything about the project so far. Of one thing he was certain. They'd do what he demanded, like it or not.
Chapter 96. The homes off of New Cut Road were widely spaced, the lots deeply cut into the thick woods, giving each a sense of being its own manor. Heather crouched in the woods beside Mark and Jennifer, near one of these houses, and settled in as the dawn colored the eastern sky with a peachy glow. They'd traveled a little over 14 miles on their circuitous route through the Maryland woods, placing them about 5 miles from Fort Meade as the crow flies. Heather would have liked to cover more distance, but had settled for being careful, doubling back on their route and spending part of the night in streams on the off chance that dogs picked up the trail. But she knew they weren't going to use dogs any time soon. They'd have to figure out who had lived and died inside the facility last night before they knew whom they were looking for. Once they found the hijacked Ford and fingerprinted it, they'd know that Mark, Jen, and Heather were among the escapees, if anyone else had made it out. All of that took time under the best of circumstances. The mass confusion added by Jack's explosions around the base only made the confusing situation worse. Jennifer had finally come out of her drug haze at a little past 4 a.m., and had now recovered sufficiently to operate without assistance. That was good. They were going to need each other at peak performance over the next 24 hours. The sound of the garage door opening snapped Heather's attention back to the scene before her. As she'd anticipated, both cars backed out into the driveway, one after the other, and drove off down the lane as the garage door rumbled shut behind them. Two working adults, no children. That and its isolation were the reasons Heather had selected this particular dwelling. Leading the way, she moved quickly to the side of the house, rapidly examining the electrical meters, cable box, and telephone wiring. It took her exactly 53 seconds to bypass the security system. With a nod to Mark, Heather moved up beside him as he broke the lock on the garage's side access door and stepped inside. They swept the house, clearing the first floor, then the second, leaving the basement for last.
"All clear,"
Mark's voice from the basement allowed Heather to reduce her guard for the first time in weeks, even though she knew it wouldn't last, for right now it felt damn good.
"You want the shower first?"
Mark shook his head as he looked her up and down.
"You and Jen each take a bathroom while I keep watch. You both look like hell."
Neither Heather nor Jennifer bothered to argue. In 20 minutes, they were back downstairs, dressed in jeans and blouses that were a couple of sizes too big, but far better than the lab coat and orange prison garb.
"Your turn. I'll take watch while Jen hacks their laptop."
Mark handed her the Mark 17 Scar H and two spare magazines.
"Check the fridge while you're at it,"
he called out as he headed upstairs toward the master bedroom.
"I could eat an elephant."
Heather followed Jennifer into the office. a room just off the foyer that had a clear view to the spot where the curving driveway disappeared into the trees that surrounded the house. Jennifer slid into the seat in front of the laptop, held down the power button for several seconds, and waited for the laptop to power off. That done, she inserted the subspace USB dongle into a USB port on the Dell laptop's right side. Jennifer brought up the BIOS screen and set the computer to boot from the USB device, bypassing the user login and password. As the Windows desktop appeared, she smiled and cracked her knuckles.
Damn, I've missed this.
As Heather watched, Jennifer began her web search, memorizing the locations of key facilities she wanted to access. Satisfied, she began a completely different kind of search, this time using the dongle's subspace receiver transmitter. Check for Jack's messages first, Heather said. Then you can start your hacks. Jennifer nodded, shifting her attention back to the web browser. Jack had a standard operation procedure of posting encrypted messages on a handful of Facebook accounts, using encryption software Jen and Heather had designed. And while they no longer had a copy of the program, it only took a couple of minutes to download the latest version of the Java development kit and install it on the laptop. From there until she had the program up and running would be a matter of minutes, not hours. As Jennifer set to work, Heather walked over to the window and peered out. Except for a few birds pecking at the grass near the driveway, nothing moved. Heather walked out of the office, unlocked the front door, and stepped outside. Moving into the trees, she paralleled the narrow lane that led from the driveway into the woods. 50 feet later, the lane turned hard left and headed toward the road that linked lanes just like this one to the highway. The distant squeal of children at play in a backyard dominated all other sounds. Turning away from the lane, Heather made a 360-degree loop through the woods surrounding the house, her movements generating no more noise than a field mouse's, despite the two big Nikes that encased her feet. Finding nothing of concern, Heather re-entered the house through the front door, locking it behind her. She turned to see Mark coming down the stairs, clad in better-fitting jeans, a black T-shirt, and a pair of gray New Balance running shoes. More importantly, for the first time in weeks, he'd shaved. The weight he'd lost had taken his already low body fat to near zero, making the muscles in his arms stand out like cables beneath his skin.
"How's your head?" Mark pointed to the band-aid at the edge of her hairline. Heather reached up to touch it.
"I'll live. You ready to eat?"
"What have they got?"
"Haven't checked yet."
Mark turned toward the kitchen, with Heather in tow.
"House like this, a couple of miles away from a store, they're bound to have a full fridge."
It wasn't full, but close enough to bring a smile to Mark's face. The leftovers included chicken wings, meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and half a pan of green bean casserole. Heather made plates for herself and Jennifer, leaving Mark to finish off the rest. When she set the plate, hot from the microwave, down beside the laptop, Jennifer didn't even notice.
"Brunch is served."
"Yeah, okay, give me a sec."
Having watched Jen in some of her programming Zen states before, Heather left it and walked back to the kitchen. If it got cold, Jen could heat it back up if she wanted to. Retrieving her own plate from the microwave, Heather sat down beside Mark, who had amazingly almost finished clearing his first plateful. The smell of the food made her mouth water, so she was afraid drool would leak over her lips as she took the first bite. It didn't, and the meatloaf tasted as good as it smelled. But somehow, Heather couldn't swallow. Standing up quickly, she strode to the sink, leaned over, and vomited into the garbage disposal. Immediately, Mark was beside her, his arm around her waist.
"What's wrong?"
Heather spit, tried to answer, and then succumbed to another retching bout. It was stupid. Jack and Janet had warned them about this, the after effects of killing a man. Somehow she'd thought, since she'd already seen Mark kill men, that she'd be immune to the reaction. But now that she'd dropped the mental guard she'd maintained throughout her captivity, the thought of the Navy SEALs she'd killed
and the guards at the NSA facility flooded her mind. America's finest, heroes serving their country. They had families, too. But she'd killed them all. And even though she thought she'd done what she'd had to, that didn't make it better. Turning on the cold water, she rinsed out her mouth and washed her face, then flipped on the disposal. When she turned back to face Mark, he didn't bother to say anything, just pulled her close and wrapped his strong arms around her body. As he held her, tears leaked from Heather's eyes, gaining volume until they formed streams down her cheeks.
"Oh, Mark, I've seen our futures, and most of them, the most probable ones, are so dark. And not just for us, for everyone."
"Look at me." Mark leaned back until his gaze held her, pulling her out of her visions and into his eyes. "I don't give a shit about those futures. None of them. I'm the now, and I've got a message for anyone trying to bring on that darkness. They try to take this away from me, and they'll be sorry. I know this doesn't make mathematical sense, but I want you to forget about any future that doesn't go our way. Even if it's 99% likely, throw it away. We can't waste energy fighting to prevent bad outcomes. The only way we're going to get through this is by focusing on what we want to happen. Visualize that. Find us a way through." Heather steadied herself, wiped her eyes, and nodded. When he tried to pull her close again, she stopped him.
"I'm okay now. I think I'll try to eat again."
As she seated herself in front of her plate, Heather did what Mark had asked. As she began to chew, she pushed all the dark visions out of her mind. As her grandfather had always said, "If you're going to bet the long shots, then let those ponies run." Chapter 97.
Eileen Wu was frustrated. The 4 a.m. drive from her Annapolis apartment to Fort Meade hadn't bothered her, at least not until she got to Meade. The post was still bottled up tight, and with all the NSA recalls plus the continued arrival of military and government investigation teams, she hadn't actually made it through the gate until 6:35. The NSA parking lot was a nightmare. The parking garage that concealed the ice house had been sealed off, forcing everyone out into the huge exterior lot, and despite the early hour, Eileen had been forced to cruise the full rows until she found a slot to squeeze her car into a half mile from the facility. Her mood didn't improve when she got to the building and discovered she would not be allowed down to her lab until after the forensics teams had finished the crime scene investigation. Worse, they hadn't even started the actual investigation yet. The security folks had refused to allow the investigators and medical examiners access until their clearances could be confirmed. Even after their security credentials were verified through the Joint Personnel Adjudication System, JPAS, security again refused to grant access. Yes, they had top-secret clearances, but they weren't cleared for SCI, Sensitive Compartmented Information, and the ICE house was an SCI facility. As for Eileen, no amount of reasoning, arguing, or even ranting and raving made the slightest bit of difference. She wasn't getting access until the forensics teams were finished. She'd even tried the old, "I'm doing the electronic forensics investigation" ploy. Nope. The cone of silence had descended, and nobody was listening. Even a direct appeal to General Wilson hadn't helped. He was already involved in forcing through security waivers to get the crime scene unit access to the ICE house, and she just wasn't at the top of his priorities right now. She'd get her chance at figuring out how someone had penetrated the facility's electronic control systems, but only after all the dead bodies were removed. By the time she was allowed into the building, it was already 4:30 in the afternoon. She paused in the foyer to take in the scene. The building was a mess. The tile floor was littered with chunks of concrete, broken glass, and wood from walls and furnishings riddled by bullets and explosive ordnance. Eileen wound her way to the stairwell through a maze of yellow tape designed to keep people out of the areas where investigators were still working. The bodies had been removed, but the smell remained, the stench of death clogging her nostrils. Everywhere she looked, the standing water was red, Looking away, Eileen shifted her focus to making it to the stairwell without throwing up. If anything, the stairwell was worse, indicative of the pitched battle that had raged inside as the Delta team fought its way down to the bottom. At the first sublevel, Eileen stepped through the open stairwell door and breathed a sigh of relief. The corridor between the labs was still wet, but the water wasn't colored with blood. The doors to the labs had been propped open to let the halon gas dissipate, and although this had allowed some of the water from the hall to run down through the raised flooring, water damage to the electronics should be minimal. Turning into her lab, Eileen made her way directly to the workbench that held the dissected Gregory laptops. At first glance, it appeared undisturbed. Then she noticed it. One of the USB dongles was missing from where it had been connected to the electronic breadboard. Glancing to the other side of the table, Eileen muttered a curse through clenched teeth. Both dongles were gone. Without thinking, she lifted the phone from its cradle. Shit, no dial tone. And she'd had to leave her cell phone outside the secure area. She thought about walking back outside to call in a report, then discarded the idea. First, she needed to do a thorough inspection to see if anything else was missing or had been tampered with. She had no intention of being unable to give complete answers to the questions that were going to be thrown at her. As busy as Balls was trying to figure out exactly what the hell had happened here, he wouldn't be happy about getting a bunch of half-assed information. Sliding into her chair, Eileen began the methodical analytical work for which she was famous. And as she worked, the disturbing imagery and smells from the rest of the building finally slipped from her head. Chapter 98. "Jack's been busy," Jennifer said as Mark and Heather stepped into the office.
"Nothing surprising about that," Mark replied, noting the clarity in his sister's eyes, something that was very good to see.
"Remember the Navajo cop who hid Jack and Janet on the Santa Clara reservation?"
"Tall Bear."
"Right.
Apparently he's become a real player in the Native People's Alliance, a new federation fighting for tribal autonomy. With all the crap that's going on out in the country, the NPA has declared independence. Tall Bear, as recently elected president of the Navajo Nation, pulls some serious clout. There's talk of him becoming the first president of the NPA.
Heather shook her head.
"What's this got to do with Jack?"
"He's hooked us up with the American equivalent of the French Resistance. If we can make it to a reservation, the NPA has agreed to take us under its wing."
Mark moved over to the window, glancing down the empty driveway, his mind on Jennifer's words. "Why hasn't the U.S. government already stepped down hard on the NPA?"
"Things were getting out of hand even before we got ourselves captured. The government's been able to establish good security in the Northeast Corridor and in the major metropolitan areas, except for Detroit, which is pretty much a no-man's land. Most of the rest of the country is hit or miss. Some areas are well organized, others not so much. It's making it hard to get food and supplies around. The NPA's a minor annoyance."
"The chaos should help us, once we get out of the Northeast Corridor," said Heather.
"Our best bet seems to be the Seneca Nation in western New York. They're a large, well-funded tribe that generates over $1 billion a year from their casinos and retail operations. Heavy NPA ties."
"We're going to need some funds and IDs."
"Taken care of. I've arranged for delivery of 3 of the identities we prepared in Bolivia. Passports and driver's licenses will be express mailed tomorrow. We just have to get to the mailboxes, etc., in Harrisburg, where I've set up mailboxes in those names. We also have bank accounts at Bank of America, Citibank, and Chase. I've transferred sufficient funds for our near-term needs. Good news. Our new selves have excellent credit histories."
Jennifer reached over and grabbed a stack of pages from the printer, passing them to Mark and Heather.
"Here's your new backgrounds. Take a second to scan them. You two can pack up the laptop. By the way, I replaced our digital fingerprints and DNA records in the federal databases with those of known criminals."
Heather nodded.
"We need this to look like a routine break-in. I'll bag the jewelry on our way out. Then we're going to need a car." They'll wonder about the clothes. It won't matter. By the time they figure it out, we'll be long gone.
Mark glanced at the clock, took a deep breath, and let it out slowly. 11:24 a.m. As good a time to start the rest of their lives as any.
Okay. Let's do it.
Chapter 99. The U.S. Food Service plant in Severn, Maryland was a big operation. The main building really formed from two large buildings whose northwest corners connected. The plant had been built to facilitate big rig loading and unloading, with employee parking on two sides, the northeastern lot surrounded by trees. It was exactly the kind of place Heather had been looking for. Early afternoon meant the parking lot was full of people back from lunch for the afternoon shift, too early for people to be thinking about leaving. Jennifer stepped from the northern tree line, seated herself on the curb, and popped open the stolen laptop, waiting 15 seconds as it awoke from sleep mode. As Mark and Heather kept watch, she initiated the subspace receiver transmitter, SRT scan. With the SRT, she didn't need any back doors or exploits such as her worm had exposed. Jennifer limited the search radius to 100 meters, the grid filling with a list of programmable systems sorted by distance, the closest at the top. People thought of cars as mechanical devices, and in the old days they had been. Now they were mobile computing platforms, brimming with programmable electronics, and anything that was programmable was reprogrammable. Most of these systems could be hacked by amateurs with inexpensive wireless interfaces. All of them were vulnerable to Jennifer, Mark, or Heather, armed with an SRT and a computing device. The white Ford Fusion, 5 parking spaces to Jennifer's right, gave a short squawk and blinked its lights.
"Looks like our ride is ready," Mark said, leading the way.
"You drive," said Heather. "Jen, you and the laptop get the back seat. I'll take shotgun."
Mark opened the driver's door, slid inside, and pressed the start button.
I-95 north?
"No," said Heather. "I want to stay on surface streets, at least until we're north of Baltimore. You ready, Jen?"
Jennifer closed the door and leaned her back against it, positioning the laptop in her lap.
"Give me a minute to bring up the traffic light grid and traffic cameras. Once I've completed the initial sort, it'll be easy to resort as we move. This time of day, I should be able to arrange for a delay-free trip."
As she began to type, Jennifer felt her hands start to shake, tremors that migrated up into her arms and shoulders.
"Jen, you okay?"
Heather reached into the back to place a hand on her leg. Focusing her will, Jennifer damped down the shakes. They were still there, just not so obvious.
"Just coming off the drugs. Don't worry. Nothing I can't handle."
Mark swung the car out of the lot and north onto Telegraph Road.
"If you need me to pull over anything, let me know."
"I'll be fine."
Heather shook her head.
"Check the local police dispatcher logs." "Working on it."
Jennifer opened another window on her display.
"Shit! We've got a problem."
"What?"
"Bad luck. Our car's owner must have seen us leave the lot and called the police. We've got a cruiser a half mile north coming south on Telegraph."
"Can you change the report?"
"Give me a minute," Jen said.
Feeling Heather's eyes on her, she scanned the police database for the record she wanted. Finding it, she typed in a few modifications, saved it, and fired off an update that would be picked up on every police vehicle-mounted computer in the area.
"Okay. Stolen car is now a red Ford Fiesta heading east on Donaldson Avenue. Virginia license plate EAN-7301. Occupants, 2 Latino males."
"Al cop?"
"Still heading south on Telegraph." "Wait, he's making a U-turn."
"After he turns east on Donaldson, give him some engine trouble." Jennifer smiled.
"He's not driving the newest model on the Glen Burnie police force, but it's got an electronic ignition system. Won't be a problem."
Heather settled back in the passenger seat, turning her attention to the road ahead. "Mark, once we pass Donaldson, take Aviation
then I-195 to the BWI Parkway. I want to swap cars downtown. Then we'll get up on I-83 to Harrisburg. What's our hotel, Jen?
Nothing but the best. Motel 6 on Briarsdale Road. In the morning, we can swing by the mailboxes, etc., and pick up our new IDs. Then we're going to need some new clothes.
Mark nodded.
Sounds good.
Jennifer felt a new round of shivers crawl beneath her skin, and this time she didn't even try to contain them. She could tell Heather noticed, but to her credit, Heather offered no unwanted assistance. Jennifer knew she was in for a fight with her body's need for heroin. For her, the NSA torture chamber was just getting warmed up.
Chapter 100.
Eileen Wu's eyes hurt, but she didn't feel tired. She felt like a hunting dog on the scent of a big cat, a really big cat. She'd sensed something was wrong with the whole Al-Qaeda escape scenario the moment she noticed that the two USB dongles had been taken from her lab. Those two missing USB devices screamed Jack Gregory's name. But why take only the dongles? Nothing about them had stood out as special. So how special were they? Eileen looked forward to reviewing all the recorded data from when she'd first turned on the Gregory laptop. But right now, she was hot on the trail of the person or persons who had taken down all the sophisticated security systems within the ICE house. In Eileen's mind, it helped to put a face on her opponent. Maybe it was a bit of reverse sexism, but the face that came to her was a woman's face. A face very much like her own. An avenging Valkyrie. Whoever the Valkyrie was, she'd done more than cause the ICE house systems to malfunction. She'd used them as weapons to blind, confuse, even kill her enemies. Eileen had never seen anything like the sophistication of this hack. Even the legendary Stuxnet worm paled in comparison. While that worm had been targeted at very special systems, this one had compromised every electronic system in the building, from cell phones and tablets to high-end computing systems, exploiting security holes across a wide variety of operating systems. The most impressive thing about this new worm was its ability to genetically adapt and hide itself. Just when Eileen thought she'd clearly identified the worm's unique signature, she'd come back to a machine she'd found it on an hour earlier and discovered that it was gone. Not really gone, just hidden in plain sight. She'd wiped an infected computer's hard drive, only to discover that the worm restored itself to a different part of the drive later, having managed to write its kernel into a programmable keyboard's random access memory. The worm was amazingly aggressive, migrating through any connection to writable memory. It loved flash memory, as well as anything that let it save off a version of itself. The timeline confused her. So did the infection vector. Clearly the infection had been present for some time prior to the attack, and as adept as the worm was at spreading and hiding itself, this was a Tempest facility. Even if she assumed that someone had illegally carried in an infected flash drive or DVD, the worm's propagation should have been spotty, with areas of high concentration and others that were infection-free. That wasn't the case here. It was as if the worm had simultaneously penetrated the entire facility, like a burst of high-energy radiation. One of the worm's behaviors had brought it to Eileen's attention. Whenever it found an internet-capable system, it opened a telnet port, then hid that port from standard sysadmin tools. Eileen had found it with one of her own special security tools, a program that created its own port map in addition to sniffing all internet protocol packets. Eileen identified other backdoors, but she felt pretty sure the telnet port had been the door the Valkyrie had used to take over the ICE house. The cameras had gone down first, followed by the facility lights. Then, all electronically controlled locks were opened, initiating the prisoner escape. All of those first events had been initiated over an internal Wi-Fi link. Eileen hadn't yet traced the source, but it was only a matter of time. Of greater interest was the security monitoring room from which the following attacks had come. Someone had killed the two guards with a series of expertly placed powerful blows. The subsequent events, halon gassing of the primary control room, diversion of camera video to the Valkyrie station,
initiation of selected fire suppression systems, and selective manipulation of building lockdown mechanisms were all indicators that pointed to an infiltrator, possibly disguised as a guard. But the fake message redirecting the security teams to defend the building perimeter had been the key. That had been a woman's voice. And it had been routed over the public address system from the security station laptop. But last night's personnel logs showed no female staff on the night shift. That left the two women in the facility at the time of the attack, Heather McFarland and Jennifer Smythe, both captured at Jack Gregory's Bolivian compound. They and Mark Smythe were people who had an interest in the captured laptops, although Eileen was mystified by how they had known where to look for them on their way out. And she was pretty sure that they'd made it out alive. At least the medical examiner hadn't identified their bodies. Eileen wasn't an expert on Jack Gregory's tactics, but the confusion caused by the Fort Meade bombings fit what she imagined his profile to be. Leaning back in her chair, stretching her arms above her head, she cracked her knuckles. She'd leave that to Levi and his team. Right now, she had a lot more work to do if she was going to be fully prepared for General Wilson's 8 a.m. meeting. Aside from who had done it, he was going to want to know how they had gotten the worm into every system in the ice house and how she was going to purge it. Two questions Eileen didn't yet know the answer to. Eileen wanted those answers.
Chapter 101. The trip from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to Salamanca on New York's Cattaraugus Reservation had been uneventful, but for Jennifer, it had been part of the descent into hell she'd begun yesterday. Heather had taken over the subspace hacks required to ensure their travel security, while Jennifer huddled in a fetal ball in the back seat, alternately sweating her shirt through and shivering hard enough to damage the car's suspension. She'd read all about the physical effects of heroin withdrawal, but living it was a different matter. Heather and Mark had repeatedly tried to help, but there wasn't a damned thing they could do except let her fight her own battle. Jack had posted encrypted instructions for their rendezvous on the web, and Heather had downloaded them. They'd led to a safe house in Salamanca, where Heather had used the laptop to remotely open the garage door. Then, they'd settled in for the night. If all went well, Jack would arrive sometime in the morning. In the meantime, as Mark and Heather started their planning, Jennifer, plagued by deepening depression, had taken herself to bed. To have so much power and feel so helpless filled her with self-loathing. Every meditation she tried failed. It was as if all her neural enhancements had amplified her drug experience as well as its accompanying withdrawal. Maybe she was attacking this all wrong. She knew clinics sometimes used methadone to ease addicts off of heroin. Not that she wanted to substitute one drug for another, but maybe there was another way to ease her symptoms. Opiates such as heroin cause the body to release an excess of dopamine. Perhaps, if she used her perfect memory of what it had felt like to sink into that opiate haze, she could trigger the same bodily response. The downside was that she'd be putting herself back into the drugged state. Her self-debate didn't last long. She needed to feel that feeling one more time. Besides, Mark and Heather needed her mentally sharp in the morning. And if her idea worked, she could gradually wean herself from the need. Leaning back against the pillows that she'd piled against the bed's oak headboard, Jennifer pulled forth the memory she wanted. As the lovely rush wiped away all her cares, one last clear thought brought a smile to her lips. Good decision. Chapter 102. Jack dropped the kickstand and stepped off the black motorcycle onto the concrete driveway, pausing in the early morning sunlight to survey the Native American neighborhood that surrounded the safe house. Some people would describe it as sleepy, but dead was the word that came to mind. Fine with him. Sometimes dead was good. Removing his helmet, Jack walked to the front door, giving it three good raps with his knuckles. Heather opened the door a crack, then flung it open wide, wrapping her strong, slender arms around Jack's neck as he lifted her off the ground. As Jennifer reached him,
He shifted to allow her into the group hug. Seeing Mark's grin, Jack released the girls and stepped forward to accept Mark's powerful handshake. Jack felt a warmth that he hadn't experienced for a long while fill his chest.
"Janet told me to give you all a hug for her. Mark's going to have to wait to collect his in person."
"That's okay," Mark laughed. "I'd rather get it from her anyway."
"Let's not keep Jack standing in the driveway all morning," Jennifer said. "Besides, everything's a bit less conspicuous inside."
"Good thinking," Jack agreed.
Heather led the group into the living room, but Jack carried his satchel to the kitchen table and pulled out manila envelopes labeled Heather, Mark, and Jennifer. Tossing them on the table, he turned toward Heather.
"Do you have some coffee going? We're all going to need some before we dig into these."
Heather grabbed the pot as Jennifer set out four cups. Jack accepted the steaming mug and took a seat facing the door, a habit so old he no longer noticed it. As the others settled into their chairs, he leaned back and smiled.
"I know you're probably all curious about what's been happening in the outside world while you've been locked away, so I've prepared a detailed summary as part of your briefing packages."
Mark opened the envelope's metal tabs, dumping the contents onto the table in front of him. He glanced at the pile of aerial and satellite photographs attached to the printed reports and let out a low whistle. Jack continued.
"Inside your packets, you'll find copies of reports Janet and I put together on the activities at the Large Hadron Collider site in Switzerland, as well as identities you will be using to individually infiltrate the November Anomaly Project. But before we get started, I need to hear a rundown on your last few weeks as NSA guests at the Ice House."
For 2 hours, Mark, Jen, and Heather recounted their captivity, as Jack insisted on hearing every detail up to and including their escape. He showed particular interest in the layout of the lab and workstation from which Heather had retrieved the subspace receiver transmitter USB devices.
"Sounds like whoever they dug up to replace Dr. David Kurtz is just as good."
The nameplate on the workstation read Dr. Eileen Wu. Jack pulled his laptop from the satchel and handed it across the table to Jennifer.
"See what you can dig up on our new friend, Dr. Wu."
As Jennifer plugged in and fired up the laptop, Jack settled in, once again looking forward to watching her work her magic.
Chapter 103.
"So how bad is it?"
General Balls Wilson directed his attention to Eileen Wu.
"Bad."
She manipulated the mouse, projecting a diagram onto the wall screen.
"This shows all the Ice House electronic systems prior to the attack, including wireless devices and approved tablets and Wi-Fi phones."
She clicked a button, and the display changed.
"Now, this shows the still working systems after the gun battle. As you can see, despite all the bullets, explosions, and fire suppression systems engaged, the vast majority of the electronic equipment is still functioning."
"Why?"
"Because the attackers wanted those systems working. One of their first actions was to kill the lights on sublevels 3 and 4. They killed the lights, but not the power."
She clicked the button again.
"And this shows the systems infected by what I'm calling the ice worm."
"I don't see any difference. Which systems are infected?"
"All of them."
"All?"
"Every single programmable component, along with any writable memory attached to those systems. And I mean everything, down to programmable calculators, MP3 players, and overhead projectors like this one."
Balls Wilson stared at her in disbelief. The low murmur that had begun around the table of assembled senior NSA staff became a buzz that was silenced by General Wilson's glare.
"Do you know who infected my facility?"
"I did."
The silence hung in the air between them, forcing her to continue.
"When I finally gained access to my lab yesterday, I noticed that 2 small USB dongles were missing from my test bench. I confirmed that they were the only things taken, then began asking myself why they would take just those dongles. That caused me to go back and review the tests we ran on the 2 laptops. As you recall from my previous briefing, I isolated the first laptop in a Faraday cage, instrumented all the laptop circuit boards to record data flow, switched it on, and bypassed the login. Exactly 1 minute later, my instruments began recording unexplained activity on numerous circuits, including the TCP stack. Since the laptop was completely isolated, this didn't cause me concern. Last night's events and my subsequent analysis of the original data indicate that my original confidence was a mistake. Somehow, without sending any measurable signals, that laptop identified every computing system in the building and infected them with the ice worm. The worm managed to hide itself, migrating to new systems that were subsequently brought in.
Jesus. Carl Oberstein's face looked drawn.
Bert,
General Wilson asked,
do you agree with Dr. Wu's conclusions?
Dr. Matthews glanced at his young prodigy, saw no fear in Eileen's face, and nodded. I'm afraid I do. I reviewed her data before this meeting.
So if it didn't send out any signals, how did that laptop access all our systems?
Eileen Wu clicked off the projector and turned to face him.
I don't know.
Gregory.
More precisely, Heather McFarland and the Smythe twins. The Ripper may have helped on the outside, but you can bet that everything that happened inside the ice house was orchestrated by those three. Worm or no, their escape was some unbelievable shit.
General Wilson stared directly into Eileen's dark eyes.
Could you have pulled it off?
She shrugged.
The computer stuff, if I knew about the worm. Everything else, though, forget about it.
General Wilson leaned forward.
This isn't the first time we've had data appearing inside Tempest-certified systems in the last couple of years. Carl, you and Levi take a look back at some of the old Jonathan Riles files from when he sent Gregory's team to Los Alamos. Find out what Gregory stumbled onto that enticed him to go rogue. Eileen, you make damned sure that worm stays confined to the ice house.
I'm afraid it's too late for that, General. But if Gregory's team has its hands on the kind of technology we think they do, that worm is the least of our worries.
Chapter 104. Mark looked up as Jennifer closed her briefing folder and rose to stand beside the kitchen table.
I'm sorry, guys. I've got to get some sleep.
Mark bent a questioning gaze on his sister.
Sleep?
Jennifer shrugged, and in that moment, Mark noticed the slight tremors traversing her body.
Heroin's a bitch. Sleep helps, even for me. Okay, Jack?
Jack studied her closely, then nodded.
I guess you can catch up with the others in the morning. But you're going to have to bring it.
It wasn't exactly a gracious dismissal, but Jennifer appeared not to notice. A glance at Heather's concerned face told Mark that she had. He understood Jack's need to drive them all hard, but Mark didn't have to like it. Especially when it came to ignoring what the NSA bastards had done to his sister. After all, they'd worked on the plan for 16 straight hours. Mark knew the construction plans for the Atlas Cavern, and for the matter ingester power station nicknamed the Mingster. Knew the blueprints, knew every aspect of the electrical wiring, knew what companies had which contracts. Still, Jack wasn't satisfied. Now they were working their way through the dossiers of all personnel currently assigned to the November Anomaly Project. Still on the docket for the night, Mark had to learn the stasis field generator wiring and construction plans. Heather still needed to study the rest of Dr. Stevenson's papers. Jack had selected their future project roles, but he was waiting for them to complete the background work before he took them through his plans for getting them the right jobs with the appropriate firms, and for getting them assigned to the desired positions on Gateway Day. Mark found his future role intriguing. He would become Gunter Fogel, a hotshot young electrical technician with coal engineering. His mission was to impress the lead engineer, Gerhard Werner, and get himself assigned to the construction team inside the Atlas Cavern. Jennifer would take on the role of Dr. Nika Ivanovich,
a Russian postdoctoral scientist working on Dr. Peter Trotsky's team specializing in the theory and operation of the stasis field controllers. Heather's mission would place her in the role of Inga Hedstrom, to become one of the Swiss security guards in the Atlas Cavern on G-Day. Dr. Stevenson had insisted that no military be assigned near the wormhole device through which the anomaly would be transported on G-Day, the military's role being to ensure security of the entire site, preventing outside forces from disrupting construction or operations. Only a couple of guards would maintain watch within the cavern, typically two or three to a shift, and those would be provided by Paladin, a Swiss private security firm. The inside guards were only there to do Dr. Stevenson's bidding, including evicting unwanted personnel from the premises. This would leave Heather with little to do on G-Day, exactly what Jack wanted. It put her in position to use her unique abilities to recognize unanticipated problems and to take immediate corrective action. While her position would be the least complicated, it would also be the most difficult to set up ahead of time. Rising from